Ready for takeoff.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to our new session on individualism, a very important topic, which, in fact, is part of the public discourse now. We talk about individualism versus collectivism. These are very important words. We need to know what they are. We need to know the ideology that underpins these words. So we're going to start with, inshallah, the poem as we do, as a matter of tradition here, and then we're going to, inshallah, explain it.
فصل الفردية فردية تعتبر الإنسان معتمدا بالذات حيث كان وأنه على سواه ما اعتمد ولم يكن لنفسه قط سند وعجب لهم من أين يأكلون ويشربون الماء وينكحون وهل على السفين يركبون وهل هم للذاك يصنعون.
So individualism is an ideology which, if you look at some of the definitions, prioritizes the individual in analysis. Now, what kind of analysis are we talking about? Political analysis, social analysis, economic analysis, or all of the above? And really, depending on what type of individual we're talking about all of the above. We're talking about all these different types of individualism. Now, what is the individual prioritized against, if you like? What would you say, if we're going to say we're going to prioritize the individual, what are we going to prioritize the individual in comparison with? What do you think? Against the collective. So what kind of collectives are we talking
society.
About? Society, maybe, yeah. I mean, what?
Tribe.
Tribe, yeah, it's a collective. What else?
Family,
demographic. Yeah, family, even family, correct, because family is a unit of some sorts. Yeah, what else? The government, that's a very important one, yeah? In fact, probably is the most important one, because, in fact, you know, a lot of the time when you hear individualists speak, you'll see them speaking about the horrors of collectivism, and they'll mention things like totalitarianism. Totalitarianism, or fascist totalitarianism, things like the Nazi Germany and stuff like that, is in many ways the opposite of individualism. At least you think it is, because it's, you know, you have a dictator which puts, or an authoritarian leader of some sort, which puts or prioritizes the nation as a whole above and beyond the individual. So a lot of the time when you hear individualistic rhetoric, you'll see kind of warnings about collectivism with special reference to, you know, totalitarianism or communism, because communism was a very strong collectivist ideology, you know, or socialism, which is once again a very strong collectivist ideology. And we will be covering those ideologies you know, in future sessions.
Democracy,
not as much, because democracy, once again, is the individual act. But we will talk about, I think you are, if we talk about representative democracy, because democracy is divided into two. You have direct democracy and representative democracy, yeah? Direct democracy, back in the day, you know, in Athens and stuff like that, they used to vote straight away for things, which is the equivalent, maybe, or something similar to, at least, what we refer to in our times as a referendum. But representative democracy is when you elect some kind of a representative. And we've already spoken about what happens when, on social contractarianism, what happens when people elect a leader, and then the leader has, you know, has sovereignty, or sovereignty, you know. Like, for example, in this country, parliament is sovereign. That is the key part of the constitution. We have a constitution in this country. It's not codified in UK. It's not codified constitution, meaning it's not written in one place. But it's an uncodified constitution, yeah, which is made up of different things like statute law and common law, and so on. So parliament is sovereign, means parliament is the main body which everything goes back to in order to receive kind of justification, legal justification. Now, individualism, although quite close to egoism, should not be confused with it. We talked about egoism last time. And who remembers how to define ethical egoism?
Self-interest.
Okay, so it's self-interest. But what kind of self-interest? What's the difference between psychological egoism and ethical egoism? Do you remember?
Ethical
is... Yes. So, right.
Psychological is something that...
we all
great. So psychological egoism is that we are self-interested. It's the proposition that we are self-interested. Okay, that even the most seemingly altruistic things that we do, like you know, a mother trying to save her child, at the end of it goes back to an interest of hers. You know, jumping on a grenade or something, you know. It goes back to an interest of hers. That's a proposition of what is the case. But what ought to be the case is now ethical egoism, because we said as the moment we start talking about prescriptions is, should, shouldn't, oughtn't, or you say do or don't even. And this one is a little bit more sensitive, because you could have prudential motivation, or you could have, we talked about hypothetical imperatives and categorical imperatives. So if I say go and clean the room, and it will be, go exercise and you'll be fit, that's not really a moral thing to say. So with imperatives, there's a possibility it can be ethical or not, depending on what kind of imperatives are being put forward. But definitely if it's about good or bad, do or don't, usually we're talking about ethics now. Yeah, and so individualism should not be confused with egoism, although there's a very close proximity between the two things. Both of them, I mean, let me ask you, what is similar between the two things? What is similar between ethical egoism, which says that you should do whatever you want to do, and individualism, which prioritizes individuals in society?
The individual is the center of focus here.
But what's the difference?
Oh, you mean the difference?
Yes. That's a similarity, isn't it? Right. Yeah. What's the difference? It's very close, right?
Is it that it's not talking about like your desires and like your needs, rather it's talking about like, I don't know, like things that you might value and want instead?
What do you mean?
So I feel like on egoism, I don't know, like you might want, like you might have like a need to, I don't know, fulfill your, I don't know, hunger or pleasures, right? But it sounds like individualism is maybe like looking at a higher level of like what your interests are, so things that you value.
But egoism can also be that,
right? Yeah.
Individualism in relation to everyone else, and egoism is just about yourself, and you don't consider how it affects other people.
You could look, consequentialism, yeah. You can have egoistic consequentialism, and you can have individualistic consequentialism. It can fit in almost anywhere. And you can have individualistic egoism. A lot of these things that we're going over in the sessions, don't think that they're always mutually exclusive. You can put them together, like individualism and egoism can coexist, but they're not expressions of exactly the same thing. Like when we talk about individualism, depending on what type of individualism we're talking about, we're just making claims about what rights and responsibilities individuals should have respective to other collective entities. That's what we're talking about. We're not really making a claim about what the individual should do or shouldn't do. This is a very fine line distinction between egoism and individualism. Yeah.
So what's the criticism from psychological egoism?
Oh, psychological egoism has nothing to do with ethics.
Right.
It's a psychological study.
Okay, but when you just mentioned individualism, you kind of, I don't know, it sounded like you were saying that it's separate from morality.
No.
It's not.
No, okay. It's not, because what we're saying is that it's morally good to prefer the rights and responsibilities of individuals over and above that of states or collectives of any kind. That is the individualistic notion. Now, if you take individualism, if you take the notion of preferring the individual set of rights and responsibilities, or let's say rights in particular, right, over and above state rights, for instance, yeah, then what do you think we will reach on the spectrum of political models? Because individualism now, we've moved away from kind of ethical systems to political philosophies now. And also to, this is a political philosophy, an ideology, a political philosophy. It's not just an ethical system. So on the political landscape, where do you think, if the more individualistic you are, the more...
No,
this is... No.
Negative.
Libertarian. Yeah, go on. So, libertarian. What's even more severe than libertarianism?
Anarchism.
Yeah, anarchism, right? So, at the extreme end of this side is anarchism. Because what is anarchism? Yeah, yeah, there is no government. There is no government. Because libertarianism is that the government has minimal intervention, like what Robert Nozick would argue for. But we still have a government, we still have a state. Whereas anarchism, you don't even have a government or a state. You know, you've eliminated the government, I say, because you've preferred the individualistic set of rights over and above the state's rights. Right, so a true, like the most, for me anyway at least, the most consistent type of individualist is an anarchist. I think that's probably where the strongest argument is. Because if we're saying the individual rights, and especially if we're using universal quantifiers to make our claim, right, that it's, in all cases, the individual should be preferred over the state or the government or whatever it is, or any collective. If we use this kind of, this language, this generalized language, then fitting exceptions in the case of libertarianism, which they do fit exceptions for police and for like basic apparatus, or even more strongly so for liberalism with social contract theory, would seem to be a stress on this theory, or at least in contradiction with it. I mean, we talked about social contract theory, right? Imagine if we remember some of the quotes that were like said by Immanuel Kant and John Rawls and John Locke and these. If you remember, like how much emphasis they put on the sovereign, how much emphasis they put on the sovereign, like, you know, you must obey the sovereign. We said in this country the parliament is sovereign, so there's still that notion there, right? And social contract is there, linked to the representative democracy. If an individualist who really prefers the rights of individual rights or prefers individual rights, read kind of works of Immanuel Kant. What do you think they will say on these things? Like,
they wouldn't accept it.
They will at least find it very uncomfortable. Yeah. At least, right? Because it goes against the spirit of individualism. So the more and more you move away from liberal notions and into libertarian notions, and from libertarian notions into anarchical notions, then the more individualistic you become. Okay, now, I'm going to present to you what arguments they make. And there's many people who have spoken of individualism. We were speaking before the session about what we refer to as methodological individualism. Now, methodological individualism is not an immoral claim. Just like egoism starts with a psychological claim, individualism can also start with a claim which is non-ethical. In this case, it's referred to as methodological individualism. And methodological individualism, it simply talks about what the individual should do, what the individual does. That individuals, or that societies are run by individuals, not by groups. So it's talking about something that is rather than something that ought to be. So we have Ludwig von Mises, who famous for his works on praxeology, you know, Austrian philosopher, who stated, who made the case, and he started by speaking about methodological individualism, talking about that is the state of affairs, like, we've got individuals in society, that is, and then he started making claims now, so he's moved away from methodological individualism to ethical individualism, and in such polemic, if you like, he gave some reasons why he thinks that individualism or that collectivism, okay, of any sort is wrong. And he gave two main reasons. Number one, he said that if you want to base collectivist ideology on anything, let's say if it's nation, religion, tribe, we mentioned all the things that we mentioned in the beginning of the session, that to choose which one you're going to pick over another is going to be an arbitrary thing. It would require arbitrariness. There's no set standard or for choosing one over the other. There's no set standard for it. And obviously a second thing which links to this is the argument that we all hear, which is about the horrors of collectivist ideology. And, you know, if you have collectivist ideology, it can sometimes slip into totalitarianism, authoritarianism. These are the kinds of arguments we find. Now, with the person next to you, okay, I'll give you about 5 minutes to speak about this. We want to discuss what you think a counter-argument from a collectivist will be. Okay, so these are the kind of main arguments, let's say, of individualism against collectivism. That this is arbitrary, they will say, you know. This is arbitrary. How and why would you establish a collective on X identity marker rather than Z identity marker, Y identity marker, Z? And number two, this can lead to kind of destruction and, you know, totalitarianism and, you know, authoritarianism and so on. If you are now collectivist of some sorts, how would you respond to these 2 points? I'll give you 5 minutes and then we'll come back. Yeah, so what would you have to say? Okay. What's your name again, brother? Tahmid.
Min.
Tahmin, yeah, oh, that's right. Yeah, go ahead.
You mentioned that Ludwig von Mises had two claims. One was that it's arbitrary to establish a collection on, you know, X identity marker, and the second was the horrors of collectivism, you know, least totalitarianism and so on. So the first argument that we would present is that it's not arbitrary to establish a collection on an identity marker if a group of individuals, they come together on a shared interest. So a group of individuals, they have, you know, they would each decide that this is their most preferred interest, is the highest value interest, and they would come together on that marker and work together to achieve that.
I think that's a very reasonable argument. I think certainly that's something you could say, but then they would argue that the moment now becomes a collective, there will be disparities in how that collective is defined, which not all individuals would agree with. So for example, let's take a nation. How do we define British values, for example, yeah? So not everyone in Britain really agrees that these are the most important values in Britain. But, you know, so a lot of people will agree with that. So then you're going to have to kind of smuggle in a democratic reasoning, which now we're going into another ideology altogether. Yeah. Because it will be the majority, the will of the majority. But individualists are more explicit about the will of the individual. But it is definitely something you could say. What else could you say in response?
We have to decide, because even if you become collective, if you become individual, it can lead to anarchy. If you become collective, it can lead to dictatorship or like.
Yeah, but for them, if it does lead to anarchy, what's the problem? They say this is what we want.
So some of them say that. In certain situations, you have to choose one. So imagine like in a referendum to decide if the country needs to be separate or not. You can't, even though, so you have 51% or 55% of votes. Understand you can't ignore the 45%, but you can't ignore the 55%. You have to choose one. So in that case, individualism wouldn't work. Does that make sense?
Well, if we went into the
So some situations require you to choose one. You can't.
Like what? Give me an example.
Like the one I mentioned.
Just say it again.
Situations like a nation needs to decide if like wills and the separation.
Yeah.
So if we wanna separate from this country. We don't want to be part of that.
Yeah, but nation states in and of itself are a questionable thing on anarchical notions. Nation states itself, the whole question of a country, like, you know, with borders and a patrol and military and stuff, that itself is, we're not taking for granted that an anarchist would say that that's possible even. Do you see?
So the stronger argument would be...
Let's start with this question. Yeah, you're definitely... Look, this is good. You're grappling with it, yeah? It's fine. It's good. You're coming... You're saying good stuff. It's not anything bad. But what I want to say is... Let's start with a very, very basic notion. Let's take it step. What are the assumptions of individualism?
Assuming that the individual right is superior to the collective right, isn't that itself?
There are some things which are more foundational than that.
That the individual has a right, has rights?
Yes, but there's some things which are even more foundational than that.
That you're an individual.
That the individual wants to pursue these rights. You must pursue these interests and values.
Well, now we've smuggled in egoism, in a sense. So whether he wants to or not is not the question here.
Refusing to follow the crowd, thinking for yourself.
Mm. Yeah, the thinking for yourself. Let's explore that for a second. Thinking for yourself. Should you think for yourself? Do we think for ourselves all the time?
Can you think for yourself? Is always in with other people, right?
Should we think for ourselves? Yeah. In every circumstance. Do we think for ourselves in every circumstance?
No.
Give me an example of when you don't think for yourself.
Don't think of myself.
Don't think for yourself.
Can you stop at red light?
Great, why not?
Because, you know, you would want to continue driving even if it was a clear road, but you're bound by that.
Well, there's something more foundational than that.
Right.
Who put the red light in place?
Yeah, not you. Yeah, someone else.
Someone who knows more about red lights and
injunctions
than you, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so the assumption that you know what's best for yourself.
Yeah, okay.
That's an assumption.
Yeah.
You know what is best for yourself, the good life, conceptions of the good, you know what's... So you could say one of the individualistic assumptions is you know what's best for yourself. Now, can that be challenged, that assumption, that we know what's best for ourselves?
Yeah. We don't always know what's best for us.
Give me an example.
So, seatbelts.
Well, I know that's good for me. I'll put that on myself. No problem.
Yeah, but some people will agree that it's no. They would just say no.
No, but now you're going into imposition. Now you're going into now the government's forcing you to do it.
Yeah.
I'm asking you, at what stage do you not know what's good for yourself? Give me examples of when there are things about your life that you don't know that whether it's good for me or not. You need to outsource it to somebody else.
Smoke.
Medicine's a great example, right? So if you have a problem... surgery, you're not going to get the and do it on yourself, unless you are a surgeon. I mean, some surgeons have done this. I've seen some videos of that. But unless you are a surgeon, you are not going to do that yourself, because you don't know what's best for yourself in this context of medicine. You don't even know what to do. All you know is, do you want to get rid of this problem? But you have to outsource that to somebody else. So there are examples of situations where clearly you don't know what's best for yourself. So you have to outsource that. So the question, the assumption of I know what's best for myself, therefore I should make my own decisions, that assumption can be put into question. But there's something even deeper than this. What you said wasn't well off, like, you know, are we individuals? That's probably one of the most deep things you can ask. And certainly some greater men, I shouldn't even say this really, but, you know, from the perspective of philosophical insight, have said that, like Nietzsche, even though we don't, you know, from the Islamic perspective, you know, agree with him, but from the perspective of, you know, sharpness, you know, and we talked about this, in fact, I think, therefore I am, so you're presupposing the individual. You could say that, but there's something more. Do we have free will? Okay, this is a question of contention. Like, okay, well, obviously, from our perspective, we do, as Muslims. The whole religion is based on the fact that we are making our decision right now. But I'm saying, as a matter of philosophical inquiry, there are three schools of thought, major schools of thought, right? One of them is the determinist school of thought. And what does the determinist school of thought posit?
That we don't have free will.
That we are puppets, where this is a cosmic ventriloquism. You know, that me moving right now, doing this, even all my thoughts, they are being guided by an antecedent causal chain of uninterrupted events. I have no free will according to this view. And this is what you could even say, the dominant view or a dominant view in philosophy. Now, if you don't have free will, individualism is meaningless. Because you can't know what's best for yourself, because you're not doing anything for yourself. And in fact, you're being forced to do everything. So the assumption is volition, free will. What you really can't have and which will be a contradiction, is a deterministic individualist. Because one notion foregoes the opposite notion. If you are if someone declares to you that they are a determinist, a metaphysical determinist, they can't go ahead and say, well, now we should be individualists, or that we are even methodologically individualistic. Because now you've defied the fact that human beings are doing anything for themselves, let alone know how to do things in their best interest. You can't do something in your best interest if you're not doing things. You see? So there are some assumptions here, and you've got to be careful of who you're speaking to when you're, you know, making the point. But let's think about this again as a group. We'll do one more, based on some of the stuff we've just said now, one more kind of group work stuff, where we're thinking about, based on some of the assumptions that we talked about, what can be said against individualism? What can be, based on some of the assumptions that we've said now, and I want you to focus on two things. I want you to focus on the assumption that we know what's best for ourselves. Okay, that's, and number two, I want you to focus on the assumption of freedom. That we have freedom. And this is, it's almost taken for granted that we have freedom. We have freedom, and we should have freedom. These are two things. Rousseau said, man is born free, but is everywhere in chains. But are we even born free? Maybe we were born with chains. A determinist would certainly conclude that that is the case, right? So 5 minutes, and then we'll come back and have a discussion. All right, so let's see, anyone want to start us off?
Okay, so so we basically talked about both assumptions, and the first assumption that we talked about was this individual knowing what's best for himself. The first assumption we talked about was this idea of freedom. And, you know, if the person is obviously a deterministic person, then obviously he can't do what he wants anyway, and therefore, this is contradictory with individualism, where a person chooses to do what they want. And then on the first assumption we talked about, a person knows what's best for themselves, we would say that we would actually, in general, need to limit some individuals because they don't know what's best for themselves. For example, someone who is vulnerable, someone who is ignorant, someone who is not sane, someone who has disabilities. These people would actually need to be limited.
Immature.
Yeah, someone who's immature, a child, doesn't know what's best for himself, so he'd need to be limited.
And if you don't mind me asking, what would be the ethic that would need to put in here in order to come to the conclusion that these people need to be limited?
These people need to be limited because that is what's best for themselves.
Okay, but what are we thinking about? If they're not limited, what will happen?
If they're not limited...
No, but if they're not limited, what's going to happen? If a psychopath is not limited, or a murderer.
Yeah. Utilitarianism.
Yeah, if a person...
You may believe that something is good for us, but not for someone else.
Yeah, but if a psychopath is not limited, and a murderous psychopath,
so
what will happen?
Yeah, he may think something is good for him. Killing someone is good for him. Obviously, it's not good for the person he's killed, for other individuals.
All right, so it's not good, but why is it not good?
Because it's violating someone else.
Good, so is it deontological?
Consequentialist.
It's consequentialist.
Yeah.
So really, in order to make arguments either way, you have to bring in consequentialism now.
But which is... Hedonism is what he's talking about.
So yeah, hedonism is about himself. Like, he feels pleasure. He's trying to maximize his pleasure.
By killing people.
Yeah, exactly, right? We're saying now, if this person needs to be limited because of the consequences of his or her actions, that means to say we are talking about what? Consequentialism.
Yeah.
Or what is referred to as teleological ethics, yeah?
Mm.
It's also referred to as teleological ethics.
Yeah, but also at times limiting an individual could be better for the individual itself, right? Like in the case of a child, maybe like walking towards a fire, limiting the child would be...
Yeah, but it's still consequences.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
It's still consequences, right? So you'd have to have it in another kind of ethical way. But still, yeah, these are the arguments that will be made, right? But then if we bring in consequentialism, and what do we need for consequentialism? We need to set a criterion. What do we want to maximize and what do we want to minimize?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember this? Yeah. So if we want to maximize X or minimize Y, we want to maximize utility. You want to maximize, which is utilitarianism now. You want to maximize pleasure, pain, minimize pain. You want to maximize the amount of stable families there are in a society. That's a consequence that you're considering. That's one consequence. But is that all that's important? There are other consequences that are important. So we have to set the consequence first. These are the desired options. And these are, and now, so there's a lot of work that has to be done here. We have to see what's good, what's bad, what do we want more of, what do we want less of? Number one. Okay, if this happens, now we have a series of conditionals, then this, and if this happens, then this. If we emphasize the rights of the individual, then this consequence will happen. And if we emphasize the right of the collective, then this consequence will happen. And then you have trade-offs now. Then you have tensions now. So we ask, if we're a consequentialist, a pragmatic consequentialist, we'll ask, which ones should we emphasize? Should we, in this action, should we emphasize the community interest, the collective interest, or should we emphasize the individual interest? Now, from the Islamic perspective, which is a segue into, what do you think the answer is here? Should we emphasize the collective interest? Is there any situation where the individual interest is prioritize over the collective interest that we've spoken about together in class?
Religion.
Yes. Yes. But sometimes, sometimes that can be the case and sometimes not. I want you to think about the particular lesson that we've done on Ghazali and consequentialism and maslaha and mafsada. And remember, there's two examples we gave at the end of the class. We gave the example of tatarrus, human shields. And we gave the example of the guys in the ship. And we said, well, Ghazali
so
said...
When you violate humans, like honor and...
Okay, let me remind you.
Is it the three people on the boat?
Yeah, so he said the three people on the boat, right?
Yeah.
So he said if there's three people on the boat and one of them... the boat will sink unless one of them comes off. He says it's under no circumstance is it okay for one of them to be thrown off. Even if the collective interest is what is will be met, let's say, in this situation. Why did he say that, if you remember? Yes, go on.
It doesn't affect the entire society.
No, but there was three conditions he gave.
Yeah, it has to be certain.
Yeah.
And then what was the other one?
Can't remember.
Daruri. So it has to be necessary. We have to know for sure that it's going to affect everyone. And we have to have a very high range probability that it will do so. So in a situation, this is what Islam says basically. In a situation where those three conditions are met, then the collective will override the individual will. If three things, if those three conditions are not met, then the individual will override the collective will.
What exactly does he mean? Does he mean like the entire society itself?
Yes. So in a situation where it will definitely affect the entire society in some way, and that it will definitely happen, or there's a very high likelihood of it happening, and that it's necessary, and we said the necessity is connected to the five things that Islam came to protect, then the collective will be emphasized over the individual will. And that is... It solves, if you understand this, it solves the controversy of penal laws in Islam. You know, penal laws like the hudud and stuff like that. Why is it so many, it's like, there are harsh laws in it, like, you know, Islam. There's laws of capital punishment in some situations, this, that, and whatever. Now, why? Because in this situation, it's kulli qat'i daruri, and it links to darurat al-khams, which are the five things that Islam came to protect. Whether it's the deen, or the nafs, that's why you'll find, or the ird, the honor of the person, all of the hudud are based on those five things. Okay. So that's why we automatically think Islam is more collectivist than it is individualist. But that's actually not a nuanced position. That's not understanding that the scholars came with that. Oh, sometimes it can be collectivist and sometimes it can be individualist.
Depending on the scenario.
It really depends on the scenario. And where it's clearly individualist is in spiritual affairs. That all of you will come yawm al-qiyamati farda. You will come individually. Literally, the word individual is there. like that you will not be accompanied by anybody in the grave. You will be alone in the grave, and you will come alone in the grave, you know. And we believe in the Day of Judgment. You'll be alone there as well, you know. And so it is. There are some aspects of Islam which are clearly preferring individual action or emphasizing individual action or referring to it, and other things which are more collectivist. So you'll find that it's very surprising, because some people will attack Islam on the basis that it's supposedly collectivist. And they'll make the same arguments against Islam as they will make against fascism.
In the situation of the what?
Yes.
Is that necessary?
It's necessary?
Yeah, I'm asking if it's necessary. Because you mentioned that to be able to be necessary, it needs to fulfill five of the...
No, just one of the five. For it to be necessary, it has to... So, for example, a woman being raped, it doesn't say for, like, if she's raped, it won't be against her life. But it will, one of the things that Islam came to protect is honor. And a woman being defiled in that manner and raped is against her honor. And so that's one of the things Islam came to protect. It's as high as the life. You know, so you, if someone, like we said to you, pointed a gun at you and said, rape this woman, otherwise we'll kill you, you don't have a choice of doing that and saying it's darura, it's a necessity, because that woman has something that you must protect. Her individual right to honor overrides your individual right to life at that point. These things are very well reasoned within the Islamic paradigm.
That's why in that situation, on the boat situation, if you throw that guy out, you know, there's no honor in
his life. His now life. It's life, yeah.
Okay.
So sometimes Islam will come and say, no, you know. So you'll find now alt-right critiques of Islam, even far-right critiques of Islam. You know, it's pretty slow and unnuanced, unacademic, but we need to know, because this is the kind of thing you're going to be confronting, that Islam attacks individual rights, Islam attacks individual freedom, and Islam is a fascist, something you'd hear from Tommy Robinson or something like that, yeah? It's a fascist thing. But if we think about this, there are aspects of fascism which are compatible with social contractarianism and liberalism, which is the contract theory, social contract theory. And that's also compatible with Islam. I mean, there's no controversy there. But there are aspects of Islam and or liberalism which are not compatible with fascism. This is how we solve the issue. And examples or counterexamples, the like of which we've mentioned now, are strong enough to dispel the notion that Islam only considers collectivist interest. It considers both. And sometimes it prioritizes one over the other. I'll give you one very interesting example. You know, if somebody curses Allah, you know, if someone curses Allah, the reasoning they give for the reason why there's no, like, say, punishment for that, in the same way that there is for other things, is because they say Allah, he can take his own rights. But the khalq, the creation can't. So, in other words, the creation, the individual creations, they need their rights to be recompensated. And in many ways, there are overlaps between liberal theory and Islam, by the way. Like with wealth and money, you can, under no circumstance, can a sovereign come and take your money. Now, some particular groups of Islam will emphasize the hadith, وَلَوْ جَلَدَ ذَخَرَكْ وَأَخَذَ مَلَكْ, you know, if he whips your back and takes your money. It's not saying that he should do that. He's saying that don't fight them because of the consequences, really. It's not saying anything other than that, really. There's consequences involved there. But the sovereign has no right to take the money of the person or kill the person or rape the person. So there are limits on everyone. There are checks and balances in Islam. There are limits on everyone. There are checks and balances in Islam. And it's not a fully individualistic system. And it's not a fully collectivist system. Obviously, at the top of the Islamic system is a theological understanding that God's laws ought to be respected. Yeah? Alright, we'll end with that because I think that covers a lot of ground, and we'll continue speaking about these matters. And we'll do this obviously in the Arabic language as well. Hopefully you've enjoyed your time at home. We surely have here. We had a lot of food for thought. We're going to have a little bit more food for thought now when we do our discussions. And hopefully in the next session we can see each other. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.